Thank you very much, Dean. Thank you, everyone, for coming today, given the weather. My name is Grigoris Karakulas, and I'm a stress testing advocate, so I will try to perhaps get you even more motivated about stress testing. Can you hear me well? Okay, thank you. As I understand, these seminars are very informal, so please feel free to interrupt me at any time. I have put together, you know, perhaps a lot of material, you know, depending on the time and your interest, you know, we might go slower, faster, and so feel free to interrupt at any point. So just a few words about, you know, oops, somehow one side is frozen. I don't know. Anyway. Just to tell you a bit more about, you know, what we do, my company is called InfoAgora Inc. We are a small company with a great track record. We try to help, you know, financial institutions like yours to optimize the risk reward by providing them risk analytic solutions along these dimensions that you see there, customer behavior modeling that actually is not only for banks but also for insurance companies. As I understand, some of you might be from insurance companies. And then under that the banner we have, you know, credit scoring, financial risk rating, prepayment and redemption modeling for term investments, for example, and of course, you know, model validation. Another area that, you know, we cover has to do with portfolio loss forecasting, stress testing and benchmarking, and we have developed there a suite of products, you know, BRIST for top-down stress testing, PubR for retail stress testing, and PubW for wholesale stress testing. And then the last but not least, you know, a solution for economic regulatory capital estimation for retail and corporate portfolios. We still have the problem though. Let's try it. Do you want to ask Graham why the problem? Okay, thank you. So just, you know, to kind of joke around a bit here, things might seem easy, might seem fine. Here we have a guy paddling down, you know, what he thought to be a creek, but actually he's paddling down Niagara Falls. So that's what happened, you know, like in the summer of 2008. Now we're here, and I'm sure you have read and talked and heard a lot about, you know, the post-mortem or the aftermath of the crisis. Here we're not going to talk so much about, you know, that, you know, the post-mortem, but more about, you know, how a stress testing program should be implemented, and give you examples, you know, throughout the presentation. The question, I guess, many times, you know, there is this, you know, issue, you know, are we talking about historical stress tests, you know, versus, you know, hypothetical stress tests, and I'm going to elaborate on this, you know, in the next few slides, you know, but it's interesting sometimes, you know, if you go back, you know, to history, you can draw very interesting examples, you know, for stress testing, and there has been a study that looked at, you know, that housing booms and busts, you know, the housing cycle over 14 countries for about 32 years, and it found, you know, that there was a crash that occurred once every 2 years, and it lasted for about 4 years, and house prices dropped, you know, for about, you know, 30%. I don't know if this sounds familiar to you, but, you know, of course, you know, it's very much related, you know, to what the state experienced over the last, you know, 3 years, and it's still not over yet, because according to this, you know, it lasts for about, you know, 4 years. And also 40% of housing price booms ended in busts, so it doesn't happen all the time, you know, but there's a high probability. So again, if people, you know, way back, this study was done, the paper was published in 2003. So if people had, you know, looked at this type of analysis, they should have actually run this type of simulations of stress testing scenarios in their portfolios instead of, you know, as we know now, assuming that house price will appreciate, you know, by 2% every year. So now how, of course, that's, you know, a general view. These days we hear a lot about, you know, it's a big question. You go to meetings, you know, you read the newspapers, you know, and everybody's asking, you know, is there going to be, you know, a bust, you know, in the Canadian housing market, you know. And there are some, you know, interesting statistics that are coming out, especially from Statistics Canada, that shows, you know, that house price to income ratio has reached a 20-year high. And you can see, you know, when the previous recession in the housing market occurred. So this is now, you know, reaching again. There was a small dip, but it was like a V shape, and now we're reaching again levels that were similar to the previous recession. I mean, that doesn't really, you know, it's just an interesting observation because you have to take into account other things, of course. Another thing that you have to take into account is that debt-to-income ratio has also reached an all-time high. And this is now at 147%. And what is also interesting is that 70% of last year's increase in that, you know, ratio is due to mortgages. So as you know, your board or you know, your CEO, CRO is looking at all these statistics, then the obvious question is, what will happen to our portfolio if, for example, house prices fall by 30%? That's something that we will look at one of the examples later on. Now, what about, you know, consumer loans, credit cards? You know, we see from Equifax, you know, that, you know, that delinquencies 90 plus are trending higher. So Canadians are falling back in their payments, from behind their payments, and at the same time, you know, from the balance sheet income statement data of the banks as they're reporting, we can see, you know, what are their credit card losses, you know, across different banks. They are also trading higher. And at the same time, you know, again, just, you know, to look at the big picture, we see, you know, that, you know, that there's a high correlation between change in employment and consumers. So as long as credit losses. So as long as you know, employment keeps going up, this is the negative of the employment change. You know, as employment, you know, goes up, you know, then this thing also will go down. The credit loss will go down. Again, looking at, you know, the top chart, you know, and the trend, you know, from Equifax, you know, and you know, if you are the CRO, you are interested in finding out how our credit card portfolio perform over the next 12 months. Given that right now we are in a very low rate environment, and what if rates go up by 300 basis points over the next 12 months? And there are people out there that are saying that Bank of Canada will actually hike the rates very fast this time. And furthermore, how would we perform versus the peer portfolio? This is an important question because you would like perhaps, you know, to always benchmark your risk appetite against your competitors. We're going to talk a bit more about this later on. Now, let's go to another asset class. How about, you know, business and government loans? What you see here is that the business loan losses tend to follow a tightening cycle. So what I've done here, I've graphed, you know, the survey of the U.S. Senior loan officers and Canadian, and also losses, you know, for business government loans from Canadian banks. You can, as they have reported them in the income statements, and you can see again, you know, that you know, there was a peak, you know, that lags, you know, the tightening. But you know, given that there is a lag, you know, it's not clear whether, you know, they will further go up or. So again, what if scenario? So if you are sitting, you know, as the CRO of this company that has a commercial portfolio, you would like to know how your portfolio will perform, you know, under different economic scenario. And also, furthermore, you know, are we adequately capitalized? And do we need to change our credit strategy? This is something that, you know, that we're going to talk a bit more about later on, but it's something that, you know, that is central to a stress testing program. You cannot just, you know, say that you use stress testing without having a link, you know, to some action management, some limit management. with respect to your risk appetite. So do you need to change your credit limits, for example, if you know based on the stress testing results? Then how about you know the whole bank you know, overall? You know what about you know earnings volatility? Loan losses tend to peak after signs of economic growth, and here I've plotted you know for the different banks you know the provisions, and you see that you know they have as of Q1 2010, and you see that they seem to have peaked, but you know given this. You know the top chart. You know that you know loan losses tend to peak after signs of economic growth. The question is, you know, is there still more? The leading indicators have actually gone up. You know, but is this you know going to further go up? You know, there seems to be a lag of about you know 6 months. Again, just you know using statistical trends. So if you are the CRO and the board, you know, you would like to know how your earnings will be impacted over the next, you know, 36 months, you know, after under the scenario. And furthermore, if you are actually a policymaker, if you are sitting in a government agency, you would like to know how would a credit shock affect, you know, the stability of the financial system over the next, you know, 24 months. These are two different, you know, questions with respect, you know, to what you would do in order to answer them. But it's all about, you know, stress testing. Very good question. I put it actually deliberately in order to get this question. The reason is that, you know, the horizon of the stress scenario is something that is, there is no best rule what to you know, how many months. As we see from Basel, I guess the minimum should be 1 year. The SCAP program in the States was, you know, for 2 years. There are certain impacts, you know, that can only be materialized after 3 years. There are some rules how to set these things. It depends on you know how good you know your history is, because you're building these models, you know, from some you know data, how long that history is, and of course, you know, in order if you go. The further you go, the more you assume that actually there is no other, secondary impact, you know, from policy making. Obviously, if there is a recession, if this is the scenario that you're looking at, there's going to be some, you know, monetary policy, some, you know, easing, some, you know, we saw what happened, you know, in the last, you know, 2 years. So the longer you go out, you know, assuming a certain recession scenario, the more you assume that, you know, that everything will be status quo with respect, you know, to the to the policy from the government. So therefore, you know, I would say the minimum is 1 year, and from there on, you know, you can play with different horizons and see which one is best, depending on the history that you have to support, you know, your models. The agenda for today is basically, you know, to talk about stress testing, what and why, what is stress testing and why we need it, the different types of stress testing, and we're going to talk about specifically about top-down stress testing, give the methodology, an example of a stress scenario, and then move to bottom-up stress testing, we're going to walk through a particular how you would go about, you know, doing this for a particular portfolio, and then show some examples, and then finish with a discussion. So basically, stress testing. People that are familiar with, actually, may ask how many of you are doing stress testing or are in some stress testing or are involved in some program. Okay, thank you. So we're trying through your stress testing. You're actually trying to evaluate the impact of unlikely, although plausible, events on certain financial variables. What stress testing is not about, you know, when the next crisis, you know, will be. We're not trying, you know, with stress testing, and this is a very important thing, to forecast, you know, when something will happen, when the next, you know, housing bust, you know, in the Canadian market will happen. That's not, you know, the case. That is more relevant, you know, to macroprudential stress testing. macroprudential testing has to do with what the policymakers are doing in order to ensure the soundness and stability of the financial system. You are more interested within your financial institution is more what's called microprudential testing, like inside you're looking at your institution, you're not interested in figuring out when the next crisis will be. So it's about what if there is a crisis. And the objective is actually to approximate then if there is a crisis, what is the possible impact. So why stress testing? I thought a little bit about what would be the best way to justify stress testing. I'm sure, like as I saw from the hands you raised, many of you are doing stress testing, and you're already believers of stress testing. But I think the best way to justify why stress testing came actually a few days ago, a couple of weeks ago, from Ben Bernanke when he was talking at the conference about SCAP. SCAP is the Supervisory Capital Assessment Program that actually ran last year, as we all know. And basically, he said that the best thing about this program was that it restored confidence to the banking system in U.S., of course, and throughout the world. I think that is a very important thing. It is important to see that the stress testing is not something actually that regulators are asking institutions to do, but it is actually helping restore confidence. And I think that the biggest contribution, from my point of view, was actually the disclosure of the stress testing results. Many times, people are saying, it's good, but we cannot, disclose these results, to analysts or to. But I think, through Pillar 3 of Basel and, through all these, success stories, eventually banks and institutions will have actually to disclose, using some standard metrics, their stress testing results. And I think that would be the biggest success, of stress testing in each institution. So being able to actually, convey this, to the street. So why is stress testing? It's not only for regulatory compliance. That's the one thing that someone actually about a year ago, when all this was still unfolding, asked me, do you think that stress testing will stay? Maybe it's just a buzzword, and maybe a year after it will just die. I think that stress testing, in my opinion, is like trying to fly a plane that has just been built. So in order to fly a plane, you need a simulator. So that's what a stress testing program is for your company. It's like a simulator either at the top level of the house or also within its portfolio. So you cannot just fly something to the dark without actually building the tools for this type of thing. And it's useful for different things, not only for risk management. That's another misconception. It's useful, within risk management, you can actually proactively adjust, limits based on your risk appetite, something that I mentioned earlier. It can be used for collections. Your workout group, your collections group can actually use stress testing in order to see what is coming up through the pipeline, depending on a different scenario. And of course, risk parameter validation, because at the end of the day, there is model risk in this parameter estimation, and you can actually shock, your parameters in order to find out, what will be the outcome. Also for product pricing, when you want to set credit limits, for a new, let's say, Visa card or a cutoff, a credit score cutoff, for loans, you can actually use, this simulator in order to roll out, the cash flows, the expected cash flows, and also for capital allocation, capital planning, and the business planning. If we are, so how much capital buffers do we need? There's a lot of discussion about procyclicality and all that. So what kind of capital buffer do we need to attain? Perhaps during the peak period, in order to protect us, during the bust period, and then how do you then go out, to raise that capital? There are different types of stress testing, and I'm going to show you examples for all but the last one. There is three types. There is the scenario analysis, there is the sensitivity analysis, and the contagion. Contagion is the most, I would say, difficult, and this is where the policymakers, like this is where OSFI in Canada, Bank of England, you know, FSA, of course the Fed, all these you know central banks and agencies are trying to model in order to take into account the interlinkages among institutions. If you are an institution, I think at least you know you need to start from scenario analysis before you move you know to contagion. For lack of you know time, I'm going to skip this and just you know focus on scenario analysis, sensitivity analysis. So scenario analysis test basically specify the source of the shock and also they may or may not specify the parameters that will be affected by it. I mentioned earlier, you know, the housing bust, you know, so what happens if property prices fall by 30%? What will happen to your mortgage portfolio? It can be portfolio driven in the sense, you know, that that maybe you're actually your portfolio has a high percentage of loans, you know, from the West, from mortgages from the West, you know, therefore, you know, you might want to actually run a scenario that has specifically to do with recession in the West, excuse me, in the West as opposed to the rest of Canada. Or it can be event driven. Basically, you don't care. What if, you know, a gold goes to 3,000? That's what people are saying now. And it can be univariate versus multivariate. One thing that is important here when we make this distinction is that, you know, that sometimes people, you know, say, okay, this is a scenario, Canadian dollar will go, you know, to, 110 with the US. And then you run this scenario. But you know, what you have to keep in mind is that there is also other variables, other macroeconomic variables that are also affected, by this. And we're going to show examples of this, you know, later on. But you know, the full-fledged scenario has to be a multivariate scenario. So if you are building, a stress test scenario, you should somehow account for this, you know, other effects, you know, through the single shock that you know you mentioned. We move on to sensitivity analysis, where basically all you care about here is just, you know, perturbations. So say, for example, interest rates, you know, move by 300 base points, 50 base points in this example here. This is typically what, you know, many banks are doing when, at least, you know, depending, I guess, on the maturity of the stress testing program, and at least, you know, in the early stages, basically they say, okay, if there is going to be a recession, in the consumer, we're actually increasing all the PDs, you know, across the different pools, you know, by 50 base points. Or if there's going to be a recession in Canada, we're increasing, you know, we're transitioning the, you know, the loans, you know, into higher ratings. Higher risk ratings. In a sense, you're doing what's called, you know, uniform stress test. You're just basing this on some expert judgment based on previous recessions. You know, for example, you know that certain industries were impacted, you know, by so much, and therefore you're applying these perturbations across the board. But there is no quantification of this impact. You know, you're missing that middle link, and all this thing is kind of ad hoc. And plus, you know, many times, based on what I've seen, it takes time to actually run these scenarios because there is no automation in this whole thing. So there are different ways to calibrate, you know, the stress test. There could be historical stress scenarios what I mentioned earlier about, you know, that 30% drop in house prices, that is, you know, a historical scenario. It could be also a worst case scenario based on a predefined plausibility from the joint distribution of risk factors. So So one thing that, you know, that the regulators are stressing out time and time again is about this plausibility. And in some cases, you know, FSA is talking about, you know, 1 in 20 or 1 in 25 years, and other regulators have adopted that approach too. So somehow we need, that has to do with the plausibility of a scenario, not about the severity of the scenario. So there is plausibility and there is severity. These two are two different things. So when they talk about, you know, 1 in 20 years, they talk about, you know, the plausibility, the probability that that scenario will actually occur, not about, you know, the impact of that scenario. But in order to do that, you know, somehow you need some joint probability distribution, some scenario, some I guess a black box there that, you know, we will put, you know, you will ask, you know, what's the find a scenario for me that has, you know, 1 in 25 years, you know, probability of occurrence. And we're going to look at that later on. The nice thing with this approach, the historical scenarios, is that, you know, you actually have a plausibility assessment, and you know that, you know, that so when you present this to the board, you know that, you know, this particular scenario has this plausibility. The other one can be hypothetical. So you basically, you know, talk about, you know, gold to $3,000. This has not happened before. This is, you know, totally out of the blue, or, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, people were talking about, you know, oil to 200. They may not have occurred in the past. And the problem with this is that, you know, that even though, you know, it's forward looking and it enables the organization to think kind of out of the box, it lacks, you know, some level of possibility. And sometimes, and this was a problem with the early stages of stress testing, where, you know, the senior management was not engaging in stress testing because they were actually kind of downplaying all the scenario. They were saying, you know, like, that's not relevant. Or, but, you know, the minute you have some plausibility assessment, some of your scenario have actually some plausibility, then I think that, you know, someone actually will buy in more into the scenario. And then last but not least, you know, again, something that was coined by FSA and later on adopted by all the regulators is this reverse engineered stress testing, where you basically want to find out, you know, what is the shock that will actually cause, you know, losses in excess of some threshold, for example, 99.97%, based on, you know, the risk rating of the organization. And of course, this is hypothetical. But again, in order to generate this shock, you need this probability distribution of the different risk factors that will allow, you know, to find that shock. In a way, you need to kind of backtrack and get to that, you know, point. So just to give you an example, taking it again from SCAP, you know, from the SCAP's document, this is the scenario that, you know, was run last year by the regulators. What the Bernanke called it a watershed exercise, and it was indeed, you know, like in the amount of time that they tried to put all this together and you know, come out with the results was pretty amazing and unique. So you can see that, you know, that there are only you know, three factors here. There was and for each factor, like GDP, employment, and the house price, there was you know, a baseline scenario and, you know, an adverse scenario, or, you know, a medium adverse and a more adverse scenario. You can see, you know, it ran for 2 years, 2009 and 2010, the idea was, you know, with some other parameters that, you know, that the Fed, you know, provided to see what, you know, how well capitalized, how adequately capitalized were the different institutions. Just, you know, for our sake, you know, the reason I'm putting this, I'm showing this to you is because, okay, it's an example of a scenario, but also that, you know, that in this particular case, someone might ask, okay, and that was one of the criticisms for this scenario. It was a starting point, but there were some flaws, and one of the flaws was, what about the impact on other macroeconomic factors? So obviously, you know, when this happens, you know, perhaps, you know, interest rate, you know, changes, you know, or you know, inflation, or all these other things that are also, or, you know, bankruptcies, or, you know, that are also having an impact on risk. But they only looked at, you know, it's almost like a three-variate. It's not a univariate. It's not a multivariate. It's a three-variate scenario where you're looking at this, you know, in kind of in isolation. And this is one of the criticisms of this. Thinking about, you know, yourselves and your organization, the way you would go about, you know, building this person area, it would be, you know, by joining forces, you know, with, you know, the economics department and coming up, you know, with the different scenario that, you know, that they have, you know, for the Canadian economy, let's say, over the next year or 2 years or 3 years, whatever the horizon is. Of course, you know, the more out, you know, going back to the previous question, you know, the more out you go, like 3 years, the more, I guess, kind of sketchy you are about, you know, what might happen. So why am I talking about all these things? Because, you know, we all know that, you know, that the stress testing for the trading book and for market risk that started all the way back, you know, from Basel I, has actually been very advanced, and you have banks that are actually disclosing numbers, you know, in their income, in their when they report in their quarterly and annual reports. But you know, the stress testing, though, for the banking book is actually in its infancy, or I would say compared to the trading book. The problem is that, you know, that banks are now trying to put together an enterprise-wide methodology for integrated stress testing. What has been typically done is that, you know, the stress testing is actually done for a specific portfolio and the type of risk, just following that, you know, silo, you know, approach that unfortunately exists, you know, in big organizations. Usually, you know, one department is running something for the retail portfolio, another department is running something for the wholesale portfolio, but there is no kind of integration of the different scenario and of the different measures and all that. The other important thing is that, you know, that what I explained earlier, that, you know, missing link between, you know, the scenario and the impact. There is no quantification of the stress test, also no assessment of this plausibility and relevance. So we don't know. I mean, just coming up with a scenario, we don't know, you know, what is the plausibility or relevance of that scenario. All this is actually, you know, making difficult the selling of that, you know, approach, you know, to your senior management, because someone, you know, will easily kind of reject and say that scenario is not relevant, you know. The other important thing is that, you know, that stress testing is not something, okay, we have the stress testing program, that's great, you know. The whole idea, similar when people introduced VAR in their, for their trading risk, you know, is to actually translate stress testing to actions management, for example, to limit management at the top of the house. So somehow you need to link, you know, stress testing with your risk appetite and monitor your limits to make sure, you know, that they are consistent, you know, in a proactive way, not in a reactive way, don't change the limits, you know, after you hit the recession, but, you know, being prepared, you know, in advance. So having discussed, you know, all this, you know, background stuff, you know, now we're talking about, you know, okay, what are the components that we need to put together, you know, in order to build, you know, an infrastructure that, you know, will actually support, you know, a stress testing program. So at the top here, you have, you know, what I referred to earlier as that joint probability distribution. You have, you know, that scenario generator that allows you, you know, to kind of fill in the blanks. So if you say that, you know, for example, inflation will hit, you know, 3%, you know, in a year, you know, what will happen to the rest of the variables, right? So that, you know, scenario generator actually allows you to do that. On the right hand side, you know, you have, you know, the different, you know, data sources and that, you know, are needed in order to kind of, you know, pull data internally within the organization and estimate, you know, the you know, the risk factors. By the way, in that same speech, you know, that Ben Bernanke gave, you know, a couple of weeks ago, he also said, you know, that one other gain from stress testing is actually how they push organizations to improve their data integration, you know, inside the organization. So that's why you need all this, you know, in order to be able to do that. In the middle, so on the left here, you also have, you know, different tools that allow you to model exposures. We already talked about, you know, retail exposures, you know, wholesale exposures, and of course you have, you know, at the top, you know, the if you want to estimate, you know, bank risk. total bank risk exposures, and then all these are feeding into the engine that allows you to simulate the different scenario that are coming, you know, from the scenario generator, and then generate different performance metrics that, you know, will finally go into your reporting. And, you know, what is missing here is the link, you know, to basically some limit management that you will then, you know, say, okay, if this, you know, limit is penetrated, this is what I'm going to do, and so on. And this is now what OSFI and all the regulators are asking you know, in the last, you know, few months, because not only just to have a stress testing program, but also you need to link it, you know, to actions. So. Yes. This one is actually for top-down, is bank risk stress testing, bank integrated risk stress testing, and this other one is portfolio analysis and benchmarking for retail, and portfolio analysis and benchmarking for wholesale. Just, you know, some acronyms that, you know, we're using. In terms of, you know, so as I said in the beginning, you know, I'm going to talk about, you know, two different approaches, you know, to stress testing. One is the top-down approach, and the other is the bottom-up approach. You know, I would recommend for institutions is actually to have both approaches. The bottom-up approach is basically a kind of obvious, you know, you basically use, you know, portfolio data, say a retail portfolio, a credit card portfolio, or a mortgage portfolio. You actually try, you know, to estimate expected changes in portfolio P&L and losses, at the end, you know, the impact on the solvency ratio. So it's kind of a bottom-up approach. You are using either account-level data or pool-level data, depending on the type of portfolio. And then on the other side, we have the top-down approach, where actually here, what you're doing, you are using, and you do this for different portfolios, and at the end, you know, you aggregate risks across the portfolios. Now, on the other side, you know, what you do, you actually look at, you know, bank aggregate data. So you're trying to actually, you're looking, for example, at balance and income statement data, and from there, you can derive proxies about, you know, different types of risk. And we're going to show an example of that. And then you can actually build models at that level for the different types of risks using, you know, summarized data. And then, you know, you can use, you know, the results of the test scenario from this, you know, top-down approach to actually benchmark, you know, the different portfolios when you are as you are aggregating them. You can use also the impact on solvency ratio to benchmark, you know, the impact that you get, you know, from the bottom-up approach. So the advantage, you know, of the aggregate data is actually that, you know, that you can use this data not only for your institution but also for competitors. So you can see actually how you can benchmark your own institution, because these are all based on bank statement data, balance sheet and income statement data, and therefore there is a lot of history. You can go back, you know, 20 years, and B, it's all public. You can actually run scenario not only for your institution but also, you know, for the other institutions, and see, you know, what happens. So just, you know, to follow then on that, you know, basically in terms of total bank risk, that, you know, that in the top-down approach, you know, we need, you know, to kind of define to find a proxy for bank risk, and usually it is defined in terms of earnings volatility. If you try to decompose, you know, the bank risk, you know, it consists of these five, let's say, key risk components: market, credit, asset liability, operational, and business. The first three are financial risk, and then the last, you know, two are non-financial risk. And of course, you know, different types have also different types of risk have different shapes in terms of the loss distributions. At the end, you know, you need to have a component that will actually aggregate, you know, all these distributions in order to come up with a total loss distribution. As I mentioned, you can use for this exercise, history of banks, balance sheet, and income statement data. You can use this proxy for earnings volatility, and that is actually where earnings are measured as net income over risk-weighted assets. And this is what is called return on risk-weighted assets. So you can use that. And in fact, you can even normalize it by taking deviations from the average. And it's actually then the adjusted return on risk-weighted assets. So this will be our metric that you are using in order to approximate, bank risk. Another approximation that you can do is actually you can take, a net income, which was in the numerator in the previous slide, then based on the balance sheet, the financial statement, you can actually decompose it into market credit and asset liability risk. These are the financial risk components, you have the non-financial risk, which is other income minus non-interest expense, plus extraordinary. You are also here based on studies that people have shown that the breakdown of non-financial risk is actually 40% operational and 60% business risk. So unfortunately, you cannot go further down just using this high-level information to operational and business risk. So you make this breakdown into 40% operational and 60% business risk. Of course, one thing you can argue about, using these proxies, this exercise, at least, it gives you a way to approximate these different types of risk at the institution level. And by the way, that's a good question. I don't know. There is usually a statement there, right? I mean that
probably non-regulated portfolio type of revenue stream, like you said, service charge, wealth management,
that kind of stuff. Thank you. To carry on then on this, given that you have created these proxies, you can then go and build models for each of these proxies as a function of macroeconomic factors. For example, you can take the loan loss provision ratio over total loans and as a function of different macroeconomic factors. And you can do this for all the previous factors. One thing that that is missing that I haven't talked about is how then to aggregate these different types of risk, these different loss distributions. And there are approaches for doing that. One other thing that I talked to earlier was actually to generate then stress scenario and apply them to risk models, and you can to the models that you have generated previously. As I mentioned, there is the sensitivity analysis where you assume no interaction amongst the different factors, and then scenario analysis where you actually apply the joint distribution of these factors in order to generate the scenario, in order to kind of go from the partial scenario specified to actually to the full-blown scenario. You use then Monte Carlo simulation in order to generate the distribution of the return on risk-weighted assets. If you follow this approach, if you do an if you, for example, you can simulate, an upward shift interest rates, by 200 base points, you can see the effects, shown at the 99.95th percentile of the quarterly return on risk-weighted assets, as you remember, we are measuring the earnings volatility as a percent of the risk-weighted assets. This is basically for your bank for the peer group, how the different types of risk, the volatility that is ensuing from the different types of risk under the baseline scenario and the stress scenario. So as we said before, we have market risk, credit risk, AL risk, operational risk, business risk, And then the sum of the risk would be just, you know, additively, just adding up all the risks versus, you know, doing the, you know, an aggregation that, you know, we mentioned, but we didn't get into that. So, and you get then the diversification benefit, which is the gain from when you actually just add up, you know, all risks. You know, what this is what is done in Basel, just, you know, adding up all risks. But here you have a better way to aggregate risks, so therefore you get, you know, a diversification benefit. No. It's percent. No, it's, I'm not subtracting this from that in order to get this. Yeah, it's a percentage. Right. Right. It's a change. Yeah, that's right. But that's a percentage over that. That's right. That is one thing that you can see. That's right. That's right. And you actually get better diversification benefit as well, compared to the peer group. Now we will move, you know, to the bottom-up approach, where we're actually looking at a particular portfolio, say, for example, a retail portfolio. So here, when we now have the portfolio data, so we can actually look at, you know, PD, the individual parameters, you know, PD, LGD, AD. And then when you talk about retail portfolios, you don't only have to deal with this, you know, parameters that, you know, Basel has prescribed, you know, for capital estimation purposes, but also there are some other behavior parameters. For example, you know, when you deal with a credit card portfolio, you have attrition, or when you deal with a mortgage portfolio, you have a prepayment, and so on. So, and in addition, there is also these other migration variables, you know, so, you know, you have, you know, 30-day delinquent, 60-day delinquent, 90, and if you have a credit card portfolio, it goes up to 179 days delinquent. You need to also, so if you try to estimate cash flows, which is exactly what this is doing, you want basically to look at all these different parameters. Stress testing is not just, you know, estimating this PD, LGD, AD and stressing them. It's actually also modeling all these other behavior parameters, as well as these additional credit risk variables, in order to have, you know, to model the cash flows from the portfolio. We know from for retail portfolios, you know, like you banks are supposed, you know, to aggregate data, to cluster data, to cluster accounts, you know, in somehow homogeneous way, so that, you know, each pool, say for example a vintage of a certain of credit card accounts that originated, let's say, in January 2000, they behave kind of similarly in terms of risk. So that's kind of the idea of a pool, the vintage being the most simpler, the simplest instance of a pool. I'm just showing here examples of vintages, you know, for a mortgage portfolio. You can apply, in addition to the opening date, you can also apply a geographic region, similar credit quality, etc., in order to pool the data. Once you have defined your pools, then the next thing is actually to form this this history of observations. This history is a collection of states that through which, you know, each pool is actually migrating over time. A pool moves from one state to the next based on some transition probability. Depending on the different parameters, for example, probability of default is one such, you know, a probability. But as I mentioned earlier, you also have other auxiliary rates, such as prepayment, utilization, if it's a credit card, limit growth, purchase behavior, etc. If we continue this and continue on our case study and look at the credit card life cycle model, so basically you can assume that this is a pool at time t minus one, and it's a bunch of homogeneous risk accounts that are actually active at time t minus 1. Some of them, you know, will migrate, you know, to continue being active at time t, but some others will actually attrite, default, or go into or bankrupt. Within this bucket here, you can actually look, you know, at this more behavior. Some of these active accounts are actually current. Some of them are in different buckets of delinquency. And, you know, also their probabilities with respect, you know, to how these accounts, you know, will migrate to the next, you know, time. I'm sure as you are listening to all this, you know, and, you know, depending on your background, if you are more in wholesale rather than retail, you can relate to similar things happening with a commercial portfolio. The only difference there is that, you know, you are looking at obligors as opposed, you know, to pools of obligors. Yeah. They leave the portfolio. Attrition. It's attrition, right? That's right. They go. That's right. It's voluntary. It's voluntary attrition. So someone closes the account and goes, you know, or pays out his mortgage and goes to another institution. So it's a similar thing. In the case of a mortgage, you would also like you would have, you know, like early liquidation. For example, someone liquidates his mortgage and goes to another institution. So then the goal is, you know, with all this data, as you have this is called the life cycle model, because this is going over time and it describes, you know, how the product, you know, its product evolves, then at this point in time you want to predict, you know, the loss revenue key rates at the pool level, and then, you know, of course, you know, at the portfolio level. And such examples of key rates are, of course, we already saw PD, LGD, EAD, but also lifetime loss, loss rate, lifetime loss. The input for all this is actually the time series of the pool level data that we talked about earlier, the product life cycle model. What I described earlier, the transitions that you allow to happen, you know, from time t to time t minus one, and this could vary from product to product, and in some cases might vary from one institution to the other, also the credit policy. If you are planning to change, you know, your limits over the next 12 months, any marketing strategies, if you're trying to perhaps, you know, have a campaign, you know, let's say for a particular segment of the population, having certain scores, credit scores, etc. And of course, you know, the macroeconomic scenario. Going back, you know, to the SCAP, you know, program, the SCAP exercise, there was a baseline, a scenario, and then, you know, an adverse scenario. So you need, you know, in order to do any kind of forecasting in the next, you know, 12 months, you know, you need some kind of a scenario. So this is what, you know, I would call, you know, the baseline scenario. You can easily assume it's just, you know, status quo, nothing changed over the next, you know, 12 months, in order to just, you know, see the cash flows from this model. And also, in terms of the modeling, you can make an assumption that, you know, that each of these parameters that I mentioned earlier, here, these parameters, the risk parameters as well as the behavior parameters, is actually a function of up to four components. There is the pool-specific component, which is basically modeling aging, credit quality, and any credit limit changes. And then you have shocks, one-time things that happen. You might want to model something that might have happened in your portfolio as a one-time thing. Maybe your collections department did not, do collections properly. So maybe you had higher delinquencies in a particular month. So maybe that's a one-time shock. And then the temporal component for seasonality and trend, and then the systemic component for macroeconomic factors. So as with any modeling, we're making an assumption that, you know, that each of these parameters is a function of up to four components. The reason I'm saying up to is that, you know, that we're not trying to say that it has to be four components, but depending on the data, depending on the parameter, you let, you know, the each parameter, each model choose, you know, the right combination of components. And then you can look at, for example, at decomposing the prediction of the key rates, the portfolio level. So it's not only to have a prediction for the different, you know, rates, you know, the key rates, but also to be able to say, okay, what percentage of that prediction is attributed, let's say, to the pool specific component, or, you know, to the interesting one, like the macro economic component, the systematic factor component. And you can look at, you can do this, you know, at you know, for different key rates. And for example, in here in our, in this case study, what we see is that actually the pool, the what's called idiosyncratic component, is actually the most, you know, tends to be the most important one, followed by seasonality trend, credit card portfolio, hence a lot of seasonality, and also, and then followed, last but not least, you know, the macroeconomic component. There are variations. In some cases, the macroeconomic component might be more important, you know, than seasonality trend, you know, but it seems to be last, yeah. Or it's the lifetime loss from the beginning of the account, or of the pool, from the start of the pool. It's a cumulative loss over the life of the of an account or of a pool.
And what would the loss rate be?
The loss rate will be at every point in time. So yeah, yeah. So one is cumulative, then the other is like a dynamic. Well, they're both dynamic, but one is cumulative, the other is point in time. The cumulative, yeah, that's right. So, yeah. Yeah, in this particular exercise, there was no shock. There was nothing. There was no anomaly, let's say, or aberration. That's right. So they were taking it out. I'm just showing to you for completeness purposes here because I referred to them in the previous slide. So in this particular exercise, so thank you for the question. We did not actually have to use shocks. So that's why I'm saying not available. So, and here I'm showing this decomposition at the portfolio level. And you can think that you can actually look at this decomposition at the pool level. So the underlying pools, and compare also pools with each other. So these things may vary, when you go from one pool to the other. Going back to an earlier slide, a diagram that I showed to you, the different components of a stress testing infrastructure. We talked about that you need on the left-hand side there was this modeling for the exposures. Basically, for estimating the risk parameters and the loss outcomes at the pool level, in this particular case, because we are dealing with a retail portfolio. So we already talked about this. The next thing was at the top there with the scenario generator, and this is what I refer to here as the model for the joint probability distribution of the systematic factors. This is an essential component, and from what I've seen, is actually a missing link in currently in stress testing programs, not only in Canada but also in the U.S. So you need to basically translate the scenario into stress of systematic factors. So when you say that inflation will be at that level in the next year, you need to also fill out the gaps with respect to the rest of the factors, so that you have then a full blown scenario. And you need to do that. You need this joint probability distribution of the systematic factors. Otherwise, all you're doing is just a univariate. You're just doing a sensitivity analysis. You're just applying a perturbation, which is interesting. It's better than nothing, but it does not give you the full picture, because sometimes the second order effects could arise from that initial shock could be significant. And then of course you have a simulation engine that takes all these different inputs together with the data from the internal systems in order to generate the cash flows at every point in time, and then finally derive the output, which can be different things. There could be different metrics that you want to monitor, such as, for example, the stress loss distribution or the capital adequacy ratio or other things. Yeah.
Kind of a simulation engine would be recommended by financial institutions at all? present.